capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Hello and welcome to this week's Level Talk program. The workplace, as many of my parents' generation knew it, has gone, has disappeared. The desk in an office, the secure pension, for many of us are relics of the past. Work has increasingly become a freelance activity, and I speak for myself. Welcome to the online gig economy, which liberates many people from the routines of corporate life, and yet at the same time brings us job insecurity. And is having major implications on our economy, some good and some bad. To talk about these issues, I'm very honoured to be joined by Ms. Reggie Keane from the School of Law at the University of Limerick, and Diane Mulcahy, the author of the book, The Gig Economy. Welcome both of you to the programme.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, first of all, there's a big confusion here. What is gig economy? What is gig work?
The way that I define the gig economy, if you don't have a full-time job, if you're not a full-time employee, then you're in the gig economy. So if you are a consultant, a contractor, a freelancer, an on-demand worker, or a part-time worker, then you're in the gig economy. I know a lot of people think, you know, gig economy equals Uber, but that's not true. It's actually quite broad and encompasses a range of incomes and sectors and industries.
Okay, Mr. Keane?
Yeah, actually, what I was going to say is that in many ways, the gig economy is somewhat of an old wine in new bottles, because it's really about the idea of casual work and about being hired for very short-term jobs without any kind of concept of being hired again or any kind of guarantee of being hired again.
Yeah.
So what we used to, back in the day, refer to as casual workers as such were hired when required and not hired when not. So could really, I suppose, the transformation is that they've now moved online and that the hiring mechanism is online, which makes it's still the same type of work relationship. It's just it's organized in a much broader way and organized with a much greater pool of both workers and hirers.
So. Mm-hmm. In this program, we're talking about the gig economy in the so-called developed countries. Now, Diane, what are we talking? What kind of professions now are we talking about that are making the transfer over already completely, if you say, occupied by gig economy people?
Well, at least here in the U.S. where I'm based, the gig economy is everywhere. So there are platforms to obtain work. If you are a consultant, if you're a lawyer, if you're a physician, if you're a graphic designer, a marketer, a coder, there are all kinds of ways to obtain work on technology, using technology as a platform. But the gig economy is also increasingly common among tech workers as well as lower skilled workers. And these can take the form of either, you know, individual relationships, like I might consult with a company and I have that relationship and there's no technology platform involved at all. Or, as I mentioned, increasingly there are platforms that remove some of that friction and make it easier for workers to find clients and clients to find workers.
Mm.
So it really is very broad-based here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And is that definition, Eddie, is that sort of roughly what's going on in the U.K. and Europe, do you know, as the same sort of parameters?
I suppose that's everything from like delivery, courier deliveries up to creating technological or artificial intelligence programs and that sort of thing. It would be the same parameters here, right?
So it really is a sort of revolution, is it? I mean, what percentage are we talking about of the total workforce at the moment? Does anybody know? You know, 1%, 20%?
Yeah, in the U.S., you know, the numbers are all over the place, but the consensus seems to be that currently 20 to 30% of the workforce in the U.S. is engaged in gig economy type of work, and the projections are that that will grow to anywhere from 30 to 50% over the next decade or so.
So, but does that mean it's people who are full-time, or is it something that you do in the evenings or the weekends or when you've got a couple of days off or something? to supplement your income. You do a gig job, you've got somebody online, whilst at the same time holding down a so-called proper job.
Yeah, I mean, it's really both. There are people who put together a portfolio of work that occupies them, you know, 40 or 50 hours a week, so it's equivalent to a full-time job. And then there are a lot of examples of people who are doing this on the side. They have a side gig to supplement their income or even, you know, expand their network, deepen their skills, whatever their particular goal is. So it really varies.
So, Eddie, it's 20, 30%. I mean, it's not really that many, though, is it? Because these people aren't doing this full-time.
Yeah, it's not, but I think in fairness, as Diane mentioned, the numbers are all over the place here because it's very, very difficult to define for, and that's one of the reasons is that you have quite a lot of people who may well be working at something else and are thinking about going out on their own and they're kind of thinking about taking the leap to setting up their own business.
Yeah.
And one of the advantages with the gig economy is that they can dip their toe in the water while still having a full-time job. And whether you'd consider them to be workers of the gig economy or workers of the more land-based workforce or whatever, it actually creates a huge confusion in the numbers. The other bigger problem in creating confusion in the numbers is that, as noted in a good bit of research, there is quite a high rate of under-reporting in that people don't necessarily hold their hand up and say, I'm working in the gig economy and I'm not paying tax or something like that, you know, because of the tax implications and of the other ideas and the fact that, you know, as it may well be a sideline or it may well be something that, like with the history of casual work, it was probably something that most of us went through at some point in our careers. So it could be the people dipping in and out of the gig economy, you know, and trying to balance it with their career or trying to balance it with homework or something like that. So it is a very, very difficult to put numbers on it. The fact that it is increasing, one would presume it's increasing purely from looking at the level of court cases and things that are arising from it. There seems to be a prevalence of these recently, which would give the impression that if it wasn't increasing, it wouldn't be coming to the attention in that way as such. But again, it's very, very hard to tell.
And I guess before we start talking about the advantages and disadvantages, perhaps it's worth just mentioning in passing that I suppose with deindustrialization and the collapse of the traditional working place, both for blue collars and for white collar workers, and I suppose I'm also a kind of nomadic intellectual worker, you know. I mean, the sort of jobs that we used to be able to hold down, they don't exist anymore, as good or as bad as we may be. So those sort of jobs are always on offer. But personally, I'm resisting it, you know, because I'm not a journalist friends who earn like, you know, 30 cents a page or something, and they're so completely overworked. But it's a tendency of our societies, isn't it? I think you said at the beginning of the program, Eddie, is to sort of repackage casual labor in different forms.
Mm, yeah, true enough. All right. It is, I suppose, there is an element of that within our society, there is this idea that we always try to develop ourselves professionally in as much as we can. So we do get to the idea of that. We like the idea of working, the autonomy of working for ourselves.
We like the idea of autonomy,
And that there is a personal fulfillment to that, and the idea that we can pick and choose the time that we work or the jobs that we do and that sort of thing. And there's this kind of almost an ideal of that. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could do that all the time, if we didn't have to get up on Monday morning and go to work and things like that?
Yeah.
But that does come at a price. It's how to balance those. It becomes the issue, really.
Diane, what are the other advantages of the gig economy type jobs, apart from not having to get up on a Monday morning?
The advantages are many. I think certainly for knowledge workers, and in the U.S., you know, higher income knowledge workers are really driving the growth of the gig economy. It's really control, professional control. You can control, you know, the type of work that you do. You can control who you work with, and you can control where and when you do your work.
Yeah.
And the gig economy is really very merit-based. So gig economy workers are not judged on whether they're in the office Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. That doesn't matter. What matters is, you know, what do you deliver in terms of value? Are you able to execute the task for which you were retained? So it really changes the way we think about work and how we measure work. It's not about face time. It's not about the process of getting work done. It's about the results of, and the deliverables of work.
It's fascinating listening to you, Diane. I almost get the impression there's two sort of conversations going on here. One is the idea that you're putting forward that it actually it's a development, a further development of the market. So therefore, those who produce better, you know, who produce well, and quickly and with high quality can earn more, perhaps, than they could before because they are mobile by the definition of the word mobile. There could be nothing more mobile than being online, I suppose. But at the same time, there's another conversation which is all about exploitation of low-paid workers, which we haven't really mentioned yet. Do you agree with my sort of dichotomy of the situation, Eddie?
I always find that question interesting because in any economy, there are winners and losers. There are people who are relatively better off and people who are relatively worse off. And if you look at our traditional jobs-based economy, there are plenty of lower-paid workers with insecure jobs, with low quality of life, that don't have access to great benefits. Those situations already exist.
Yeah.
The gig economy is not a panacea. It doesn't solve all of the problems of our economy. So those situations continue to exist in the gig economy. I mean, low-paid work and insecure situations are, you know, I like to say, the persistent bane of our society and our economy. They don't go away in the gig economy, but nor are they a problem that the gig economy has created.
Okay, that is a really interesting perspective. Thank you. Eddie, what would you like to...
I would echo some of what Diane says in that any developments in any economy like the... I'm sure that at the time when the Industrial Revolution occurred, there were also winners and losers. There were people who couldn't gain the skill of operating machinery and therefore couldn't gain work in the factories or in that way. So with every development, there are always, unfortunately, going to be winners and losers. What I think is somewhat of an advantage to this is that it is possible to, with the expansion of the gig economy into service industries and into both high and low-tech work, that there are opportunities there for people who may have been, I think of the idea how economies have developed in Europe in particular, that a lot of manufacturing has left Europe, and those who worked in manufacturing would have to reskill or upskill in order to gain work. But in reality, once you look at the idea of the gig economy, allows access to a market worldwide in a way that anything that's internet, anywhere there's an internet connection. So it wouldn't necessarily require so much more upskilling in order to gain work again. It does offer a broader potential for work. The problem is that there is an element of people competing for work, which is always the issue, I think, in any economy, that you're going to have more workers than work that is available. So there's a problem that it causes that, but it's not necessarily, as Diane says, it's not necessarily caused or solved by moving the work organization to online platforms.
Right. It's very interesting. Let's take a short break here, and when we come back, I'd like to talk, please, about some of the specific problems and in legislation and taxing, and also I'd like to talk about some of those specific advantages. So, Diana, please, if you can get ready some good news stories, you know, that'd be great. Let's take a short break here.
Going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Welcome back to Level Talk Programme. Today I'm talking about the gig economy with Eddie Keane from the School of Law at the University of Limerick, and Diane Mulcahy, the author of the book The Gig Economy. So we've sort of, in a way, we've sort of had a broad view of this situation, this amazing thing called the online gig economy. But what about the problems? Eddie, you mentioned that the number of court cases that you've come across or been involved with is increasing, which would tend to indicate that there is some sort of underlying legislative problem, at least in Ireland. What is the situation, legislatively speaking, with the gig economy in broad terms?
In broad terms, the gig economy, the workers in the gig economy suffer from the same issues as most casual workers would be, in that the protective legislation in Western Europe in particular is based on a dichotomy that you're classified workers as either being an independent contractor capable of looking after their own interests or an employee who would be considered to be vulnerable and therefore in need of protection for a variety of reasons.
Yeah.
The issue is that that through, and I won't say an accident of history, but for historical reasons, we tend to equate employees with those who have particular attributes. And the attributes, effectively in Western Europe, the attributes would have been those of a servant in the older master and servant era. So when we're looking at whether somebody is, whether protective legislation applies to somebody or not, what we actually look for are specific attributes that a servant of type would have had, such as the ability of the hirer to control what it is the worker does, when they do it, how they do it, and things like that.
Yeah.
Probably the more common one, the biggest problem that's come up now, is the idea that the servant owed a duty to show up at work every day, and the master owed a duty to provide work, and there was this kind of mutual obligation between both. When you try to transfer that across to an average casual worker or an average gig worker, what you're really looking at is, does the gig worker have to perform duties in the future? Are they obliged to perform duties in the future for that particular hirer? And at all times, the answer will be no. And that excludes the gig worker from being an employee, which then excludes them from protective legislation like minimum pay or holiday entitlements or any of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Now, in the UK, there has been a slight wrinkle on that, in that the specific legislation in the UK creates a third category of worker. And most of the cases that have come up in this area recently has been where, like, courier workers and things like that have been trying to be classified as workers for some of the basic protective rights, such as minimum pay and holiday entitlements and that sort of thing. And they've actually, now, because of the individual circumstances involved, they have won. But in broader terms, for most gig workers, there would be outside the protective legislation, which creates a quite vulnerable situation for them. And couple that with the fact that they can be, in many situations, competing against each other for the work, it means that you could get into this famous phrase of a race to the bottom, as such it is.
Right, race to the bottom, yeah, exactly, yeah. But Diane, that's not the way that you see it in the States. I mean, from listening from what you were saying in the first half of the programme, you're really talking about professionals maximising on their skills and talents to be able to utilise the market in a way that chooses them, rather than the other way around. So maybe we're talking about, it depends on country legislation. I mean, with UK and Europe perhaps being more interested in protecting the rights of the employees than a more all-out-and-out market-based economy such as you have in the States. What do you think?
Well, there have been a number of similar lawsuits here in the U.S.
Oh, they have, okay.
About whether gig economy workers are employees. But to me, you know, this is a failure of public policy that has shown up in the court system where it doesn't belong. I mean, if the workforce is changing, sticking to this idea that we've bifurcated the workforce into employees and contractors doesn't really make sense anymore. I think as a society, and this applies in Europe or in the U.S., I think as a society we need to step back and say, what is happening to the way that we work? Technology and globalization is changing everything. And how do we as a society want to treat workers, all workers, no matter where, when, how, or how much they choose to work? What protections do we want to offer them? What rights do we want to offer them? What benefits do we want to offer them? And they should really apply to one category, which is workers, people who are working.
What do you think should happen, Diane? Do you think there should be a sort of universal social security network to perhaps protect people?
Well, I don't think there ever were any guarantees, and I don't think that there is no such thing as job security. Even if you're a full-time employee, you are insecure. There is no job security. At any moment, your job can be eliminated, automated, contracted out, consulted out. I mean, that's gone. That's an old way of thinking.
Okay. May I come up with perhaps a very bright idea? It could be actually a really stupid idea, but allow me to say it anyway. What about universal basic income? What about if everybody was paid a basic amount of money, regardless of whether they're unemployed or employed, or whatever they were doing, a doctor or a mechanic, whatever, and that money was there all the time, and then they could take and leave these jobs and still know that they've got some money coming in to buy food and pay the rent? Would that work in the States?
If I could, there's what is known as the flexicurity system that operates within some of the northern European states, in Denmark in particular now, and the Netherlands. And it operates on the idea that there is the social welfare protection is, the social welfare payment would actually be very, be quite high. It would be like 80 to 90% of the average earnings for a reasonably lengthy period of time. But the taxation system is also much higher in that there's a payment made through the collective organisations and all.
Well, but, sorry, Eddie, but how do you levy taxes in a gig economy? I mean, how does, who's responsible for paying the taxes?
Effectively, what you're paying is a higher rate of corporation tax that the companies would, the hirers would be paying a higher level of tax in order to have the freedom to hire or dispose of the workers at will as such, as in the US, that there would be a high level of corporation tax to create the social net there. I'm not entirely sure that that's where it should be going, to be quite honest about it, because it has its advantages, and I think it has its disadvantages as well, in that there can be an element of moral hazard involved, in that if the social security, it is meant to promote transitions between in and out of work, and it will do that as such, but whether there would be still an element of moral hazard involved or not, I'm not personally entirely sure. I think what the issue becomes, and what Diane is saying as well, is that this idea of we have an employee with specific attributes who deserves protection because they are an employee. I think that exactly as Diane says, that we should look at the workforce now rather than looking for attributes that were occurring 150 years ago.
Yeah.
And what we should say now is, what defines vulnerability now? Is it a lack of income security? And if it is, then we should perhaps some sort of a basic income. Or is vulnerability being financially dependent upon one person? Or how do we define vulnerability? And then how do we protect against that? Is it going to be, as you say, a basic income or a minimum wage entitlement? Or I'm not entirely sure about anything that is universal, because I think we should really only be protecting those or targeting resources at those who are vulnerable in this market.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, Diane, I'd like to ask you now, tell us some good news stories of things that have worked out on the gig economy, and, you know, the way that things could be if they go right.
The way that things could be if they go right.
Yeah.
Well, I think what the gig economy offers is the opportunity to have more control over your work, control over your schedule, and it allows for more security because you can have multiple streams of income. So I think it calls to question, is the idea of unemployment a dated idea? When you can constantly pick up work or secure gigs for yourself and have multiple streams of income, you know, is there such a thing as your income going to zero? I think the gig economy also offers people a way to take additional time off in their lives. I mean, instead of being subject to the scheduling and workload of one employer, you have a lot more control over your time. It makes it easier to balance your personal and professional life, your personal and professional priorities and goals. So it really offers a much more independent, proactive way of working. And it's interesting because earlier we talked about lower skilled workers who weren't very well paid. And there's been some research here in the U.S. at MIT about workers in quote unquote bad jobs where they are not well paid, don't have access to benefits, don't control their own schedule. And what the gig economy offers to them is the opportunity of moving from a bad job into better work, meaning they might still not be very well paid or not have access to benefits, but they have control over their schedule and their lives. So the difference between somebody who is putting together a portfolio of gigs versus somebody who is subject to the scheduling whims of Walmart or McDonald's or Starbucks can be enormous. It means that you can schedule to take classes at your local community college. It means that you can schedule to reliably take care of your kids and pick them up from school. So the quality of life difference can actually be quite meaningful in the gig economy.
But Dan, that's terrible. What will happen to Walmart and McDonald's, Starbucks?
Yeah. Couldn't tell you.
Terrible.
They'll have gig workers, I suppose.
Yeah. Eddie, could you please, if you wouldn't mind, give us the other side story, as I always like to sort of balance these programs if possible. Tell us what could happen in a bad case scenario, you know, if things don't go right. Yeah.
I think one of the distinct advantages, and it's in a report that I came across recently that was production by the Oxford Internet Institute, and they quote a person from the Philippines saying, "For me, it's a high-paying job because now I was able to afford an apartment, pay my own bills, my own internet connection, my own cable, paying for our own food, for my kids' milk. That's all on my own."
Mm.
For somebody in the Global South where the local pay conditions may not be well, if they are getting a job paid at the rate that it would be in the more developed countries, there is a potential for them to do really well there. So it does open up new possibilities for people who wouldn't, who for the local conditions wouldn't necessarily be that good.
But it also means that it opens up the possibilities for employers to outsource a lot of their jobs out to the Philippines or wherever, which means
true.
That, you know, it's going to be very difficult to get those kind of levels of income that we're used to in the West.
True, all right, Chad. There is this, and here's the thing, we're moving back towards the bad news again now, aren't we, with this race to the bottom theory. But that said, outsourcing is not necessarily a new phenomenon. Call centers and things like have been outsourced for quite some time. So there are downsides to it. There is also the option that it does provide opportunities for people who wouldn't necessarily have them. And it does, literally, as you say, it's the most mobile of workforces. All you need is an internet connection and a laptop. Away you go.
Okay, well, I'm devastated by this program. There's so many interesting facets to it. We definitely not have got to the end of it at all. There's a whole other topic, of course, a Pandora's box of looking at what the gig economy is doing to countries in the third world. And we shall come back to that topic in a week or two. But I would like to thank you very much indeed, Eddie Keane from the University of Limerick and Diane Mulcahy, the author of the book, The Gig Economy. Really interesting discussion. Thank you very much indeed, both of you.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
Thanks for having us.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us today. Tune in again next week. Goodbye.